So I'm actually not going to read any of the story to you guys. I'm going to just sum it up because it's a story that you guys have probably already heard. But even if you haven't, it's long. Okay, it's long, and it would take me a long time to read it. So I'm just going to sum it up to you guys. What's happened so far is Jacob has had 12 sons between four wives, and his favorite wife, Rachel, had two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And Jacob completely ruined his family by showing intense amounts of favoritism to Joseph. He favored Joseph above all of his other brothers, and that incited them to hate Joseph. They hated him so much, in fact, that at one point they took him and they took his coat of many colors and they stripped it off of him and they threw him into a pit, planning on letting him die there. But one of his brothers, Judah, got this bright idea, and he said, why should we let him die in this pit? We don't get anything for that. Let's sell him into slavery, and then we can get some money off of his betrayal. And so that's what they do. They sell him to some Egyptian slave traders who are going down to Egypt, and they ended up getting some money. Then they take his cloak, they rip it up like an animal got to him, and they put some blood on it, and they give it to their dad, and they say, look, you know, Joseph's been killed. You know, what are we going to do? This is what's gone on. So because of that, Jacob and the rest of the family are convinced that Joseph is dead, so no one's looking for him. And now he is sentenced to slavery in Egypt, which is not a fun place to be sentenced to slavery, right? Egypt is a lot like Tucson, right? You know, it's desert, it's not fun. They're definitely not treating him the best because the Egyptians were intensely racist against Joseph's people because they hated shepherds. They were farmers. So Joseph is in this really terrible situation. And we're going to talk a little bit later about why he reacts the way that he does. But something happens to Joseph in this time. Something very interesting because by all accounts, this kid who was doted upon his entire life, was incredibly selfish and spoiled, suddenly becomes a good guy. We'll talk about why that happened to him. But he becomes a good man, and he ends up serving his hardest in this terrible situation. And his boss notices. His boss is a higher up inside of the court of Egypt, and he notices how hard Joseph is working, and so he promotes him. He puts him in front of his entire household. But, unfortunately, not only the boss noticed Joseph, but the boss's wife notices Joseph. And she becomes attracted to him. So attracted to him that she begs him to have sex with her pretty much every day. And Joseph continuously runs from her. Until one day they're in a room alone, and she grabs his shirt and she says, you will have sex with me. And Joseph says, nope. And he sprints out of the room naked, and she has his cloak. And so now she's free to spread slander about him. So what she does is she tells everybody that Joseph tried to rape her, and she was able to get him off of her, and he ended up running away. And she tells everybody this story. So Potiphar, Joseph's boss, hears it. He gets, understandably, very angry with Joseph, and he immediately sentences him to prison for life. Right? So Joseph went from being a slave in Egypt to a prisoner in Egypt. So his situation is getting worse and worse. But even as a prisoner, he still doesn't let this get him down. He continues to be faithful as a prisoner until his, I don't know what you would call it, the head of the prison. I don't know what that is. But anyway, the head of the prison notices the warden in the prison notices what a great guy Joseph is. And so he puts Joseph in charge of the entire prison. And so Joseph is now the head of a prison. I don't know if that's a good job or a bad job, but he's the head of the prison now, and he's taking care of everything in the prison. And eventually two people from Pharaoh's court get sentenced to prison, a butler and a baker. And they both have these weird dreams. And I got to tell you guys, when I was a little kid and I heard these dreams, this part of Genesis like freaked me out. And because these dreams are like really disturbing. Like the first guy, he has this really weird dream where he's like he's sitting there, and then these like birds come and they start eating off this basket on his head. And this other guy has a dream kind of similar to that. And Joseph looks at the first guy and he says, dude, this dream is from God, man. And you're going to be set free. It's going to be all good. And the second guy's like, dude, what does my dream mean? And Joseph says, you're going to be set free, and then you're going to be impaled on a stick, and birds are going to eat your flesh. And the guy's like, OK, Okay, that's a great interpretation. So I had 3 days, both dreams come true. One guy is set free and the other guy is impaled and birds eat him until he's dead. And so the guy who got set free is like, man, Joseph, you're amazing, dude. I'm going to put in a good word for you. You're going to be out of here in a sec. He forgets. For 2 years, he forgets about Joseph. And that's definitely a major, like, my bad situation. I don't think that cuts it at that point, you know, when you forget about someone for 2 years. But after 2 years, Pharaoh himself has this weird dream. And this is the dream that really disturbed me as a kid. He has this dream that there is these 7 fat cows sitting by the bank of the Nile. And then these 7 skinny cows come out of the river and they eat them. And that's like really, it's just like, that's gross, man. It's like this weird zombie cows come out and they eat the fat cows and it's really odd. And then he has this other dream where there's like these 7 big stalks of corn and then these 7 withered stalks of corn eat the big stalks of corn. And he wakes up and he's like, dude, that's freaking weird. I've never had a dream like that. This got to mean something. So he brings in all of his sorcerers. He brings in all of his magicians. And he's like, what is this? What does this dream mean? What's going on? And they're like, I don't know. That sounds really weird, King. We don't know what to say. And then the baker's like, dude, you know what? I remember there was this dude when I was in prison, and he interpreted our dreams, and I forgot for 2 years, you know, my bizzles, you know. And Pharaoh's like, dude, get this guy up here. So they bring Joseph up. He listens to the dream, and Pharaoh says, can you tell me what it means? And Joseph says, dude, I can't tell you what it means, but God can tell you what it means. And this is what he's saying. For the next seven years, we're going to have a time of prosperity like we've never seen before. It's going to be amazing. Our country's economy is going to go through the roof. It's going to be incredible. We're going to get more crops than you could ever know what to do with. And then after that, for 7 years, we're going to have a time of drought and famine like we've never seen before. We're going to have a depression. And it's going to be so bad that it's actually going to extend into all the regions around us, and it's going to end up killing everybody. And he says, the only way to get rid of this, the only way to stop this from happening, is during this next 7 years of increase, we need to take a tax from everybody. We need to take a fifth of everything that everyone makes. And if we do that, we'll have enough saved up to protect us for the following 7 years of drought and famine. And the Pharaoh listens to us, and he's like, man, that sounds like a great idea. Joseph, you're in charge. You're in charge of this situation. In fact, not only are you in charge of this situation, you're in charge of the country, bro. He's like, dude, I'm gonna raise you up to the place of power where you are essentially the Pharaoh. The only thing that I'm going to be above you in is my throne. So Pharaoh does like all great CEOs do in this country, and he pawns off all of his work on one guy, and he takes a siesta, right? For the rest of his administration, he just sits back. And now Joseph is literally in charge of the entire country. The entire country is under his hands. And as we know, we're not going to get into it today. We're going to stop at chapter 42, where this has happened. But as we know, this leads to the salvation of the entire Middle East. Because Joseph does this, he ends up saving up enough food, not only to save all of Egypt, but to save the entire Middle East, which includes his family. Also during this time, Pharaoh marries him to a woman, and they have 2 children. The first one is named Manasseh, and the second one is named Ephraim. And we'll talk about those kids later. So what are we supposed to get out of this story? It's a cool story. It's an interesting story. Like I said, when we watch that movie, Patterns of Evidence, we'll actually see there's actually a lot of historical evidence for this story happening, that it's a reality. And that's really cool. But the Bible's not written to give us a good grasp on history. That's not the purpose of the Bible. It's not a history book. It's a book to help us know God. So what are we supposed to learn from these chapters of the Bible? The first thing that I want to focus on is back in chapter 39, when Potiphar's wife grabs Joseph and is telling him to have sex with her. I want to focus on both her and Joseph. And we're going to be talking about something called lust. Now, it's really interesting. I've always brought this story up to people because there was this thing that was happening in America for a while. I think we're moving past it now, which I'm thankful for. But there was this thing that was happening in America where people were saying that women only lusted emotionally, meaning that women, they're more emotional, and they just think about, you know, like a good relationship with a guy, and that's how they lust. And I was always, even as a kid, I was like, I don't really see that. You know, when I went to high school, I didn't really see that. You know, and I would walk in, you know, supermarkets, and I would see magazines that were marketed towards women, and they have dudes that are sweaty with their shirts off with six packs, and I'm like, I'm not really sure that's an emotional attraction. You know, I'm not sure girls are looking at that being like, man, like, I bet that guy has a great personality. You know, like, that's, it's definitely meant to showcase something else. And I would walk down the bookstore, and there's the Harlequin romance section. And once again, it's a bunch of shirtless cowboys with six packs. And I'm like, once again, I mean, I guess there's an emotional component to it. But I mean, there's definitely more like a visual thing happening. And this chapter definitely proves it. She's not attracted to Joseph's personality. She's not like, I want to date you, you know, and let's talk about feelings. You know, that's not, she's like, dude, let's have sex. Like, that's what she says to him. And she's being very forceful and actually very domineering towards him, which is kind of interesting. And what this shows is that lust is in everybody's heart. This idea of sexual lust is in everybody's heart. It may look different for different types of people, but it's inside of everybody. And it's really important to understand this, because if you let somebody else tell you how you lust, you're going to start to believe them. And then you're going to start thinking that you're weird. This is what I mean. If you're a girl and you hear all your life that girls only lust emotionally, and you start seeing yourself lust physically, meaning you start seeing yourself looking at guys and being like, I like that, that's really awesome, I think I do want to have sex, you're going to start feeling like a pervert. You'll be like, there's something wrong with me. I mean, I guess I'm the only girl who does this. You know, even me as a guy, as a man growing up in the church, I used to think that, like, dude, I don't think anybody thinks sexually in here at all. You know, I thought I was the only one. I thought I was just like this little 13-year-old pervert, you know, sitting in church, and everyone else is thinking holy thoughts. And I'm looking around, I'm like, well, I think that girl's cute. And I'm like, I'm sick, you know, like, there's something wrong with me. And I thought there was something really, really the matter with me. And I love the Bible, because the Bible is just so real. It's like, no, like, everybody lusts. Everybody lusts. It's in the Bible. It's very clear. Not only is Potiphar's wife lusting, but we'd actually make a case that Joseph was lusting too. Why do I say that? Well, remember what happens. She corners him in a room. She grabs his cloak and she says, lie with me. And he sprints out of there butt naked. And it's like, why would he do that? I mean, unless this woman is like, you know, Jillian Michaels and is super buff and he's worried that she's going to, like, you know, take advantage of him, I'm doubting that Joseph was really worried that this girl could beat him up. I think it's pretty obvious to me when I read this story that the reason why he sprinted out of the room is because he was what? Tempted. Does that make sense? If he wasn't tempted at all, he would just be like, look, girl, you know, no means no. He would have taken her hand off of him, and he'd be like, I'm going to go back to my work, and he would have walked away. And that would have been it. But the reason why he ran out of the room is because he was tempted too. You know, lust is, it's in all of us, and beyond that, it's very powerful. It's very, very powerful desire that's within all of us. And we'll talk a second about what Joseph did and why we're called to do the same thing. But the next thing I want to talk about is, when you have lust like this inside of your heart, which we all have, by the way, the thing that really gets us, the thing that Satan wants to do to us, at any rate, is he wants to separate us. And the way that he separates or isolates us is through the power of shame. So if Satan can convince you that you are alone in your struggle, and you feel isolated and you feel disgusting, you're not going to talk about it. And the more you don't feel comfortable talking about it, the more power it's going to have over you. The power of lust is fed through guilt and shame, because one of the major things that feeds our lust, which is really weird, it's something, I'm just going to throw this out there, I'm not going to explain it, unfortunately, it's something just for you guys to ponder in your own minds. One of the key components to most people's sexual lust is insecurity. Okay? Once again, this is something for you guys to ponder on in your own hearts. But one of the key components to most people's sexual lust is insecurity in your own life. And here's the thing, if that's true, that insecurity is feeding your lust, what's it going to do to you the more you think that you're alone and you're perverted and you're sick and you're not willing to talk about it? It's going to increase your what? Insecurity, which is going to make you lust more, which is going to make you more insecure. And so it's going to just be this vicious cycle inside of your life. See, the Bible is really cool because it basically exposes all of our facades, right? Anyone who comes into church and pretends that they don't have sexual lust inside their hearts, so they don't lust at all, is a liar. We all have lust inside of our hearts. We all have desires that go against what God has for us. Like I said, those lusts may look different, right? You might not lust the way that Potiphar's wife lusts. Maybe you do lust in a more emotional way. And by the way, that's not just for women. I've talked to men who are like that. I've talked to a lot of men who, man, they're having affairs with girls just over, you know, Facebook and stuff like that. They've never touched them physically. They just like the emotional part of emailing these girls and flirting with them. And that's how they get their arousal. And hey, that's something. That's not the way I lust, but it is a way to lust. Do you guys get that? And the thing you have to understand is we all do it. And if you don't understand that we all do it, you'll never feel safe enough to confess to somebody, to talk to somebody about your own sexual lust. And you'll just deny it, right? You'll deny it your whole life. You'll be looking around, you'll be a dude, and you'll look at a girl, and you'll be like, man, she's cute. No, that's not right. You know, she's not cute. You know, and you'll try to deny it. It's like, what are you saying? You know, you're saying she's actually not pretty? You know, she's not attractive? No, you know, and you're going to look away, and you're going to try to deny it inside of your heart. And it's just not true. It's not accurate. You're never going to actually be dealing with what's going inside of you. You guys get that? And in order to understand what's actually going on inside of you, you have to be able to fight it. And in order to fight something, you have to acknowledge its existence. Denial will never get you victory. You have to acknowledge that something is there if you want to actually have power to fight it. So we need to defeat shame, the shame of lust, if we're going to end up dealing with our lust. And the only way to defeat the shame of your lust is to admit it. Right? And I've told you guys before, that's one of the reasons why I went to the world when I was 13, why I became an atheist, because there was one place where I didn't feel shameful about my lust, and that was with my atheist friends. Right? I didn't feel like a scumbag when I was hanging out with them, which is bad because then I became a much worse person as a result. I needed to be able to acknowledge my lust in front of people who also struggled, but who also acknowledged the fact that it was wrong. Do you guys get that? That was the only way I was going to get help. I just wasn't ready to do that. It took me about 10 years to finally do that. So my encouragement to you guys is find somebody who's safe to talk to about these things around you and talk about it with them. You know, it could be your parents, could be someone in your family, could be someone in the church. Just sit alone with them and be like, hey, man, this is some of the stuff that's going on in my life. And don't get me wrong, I know how terrifying that is. The first person I confessed to about struggling with this was my dad. That was a weird conversation, you know, like it was an awkward one. But I was like, hey, Dad, you know what? I watch porn, you know, and I was so thankful that my dad met me with, you know, love and forgiveness and mercy. I was really grateful for that. But I had to get that in me to just be okay with that awkward situation so that I could start getting help. And ever since then, my struggles with lust have gotten a lot better. They're still there, but they've gotten a lot better. The next thing I want to focus on is this thing that Joseph does. Now, as a man, I don't know if you ladies are like this. I assume you are, because I just assume that. You know, I watch Disney princess movies, and it seems like the Disney princesses are becoming more and more brave. But, you know, and we don't see retreat as a manly thing, do we? You know, I never saw it as a manly thing. I was like, no, you know, like, I want to be able to stand up to my lust. You know, I want to be able to look lust in the face and say, no, you know, and that's what I thought was strong. And it took a while for God to reveal this to me, but he's like, you don't want to be strong, you want to be proud. You want to be independent. Let me explain that. In 2 Timothy 3, verse 10, I actually have the verse up there so you guys could take a look at it. No, I'm sorry, not 3, verse 10. I'm sorry. It's going to be chapter 2. I don't have that verse up there. My bad. This is chapter 2, verse 22. Paul talking to Timothy, he says, flee youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart and a good conscience. So Paul is exhorting us to do exactly what Joseph did. He doesn't say negotiate with youthful lusts. He doesn't say fight youthful lusts. He says flee youthful lusts. Jesus says something similar to this as well. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 27, Jesus says, if your right hand causes you to sin or to lust, he says, cut it off and cast it from you, for it is better for you to be maimed and go into heaven than to be whole and go into hell. Right? So Jesus is also telling us that we shouldn't negotiate with our sin, but we should cut it off. We should throw it away from us. We should flee from it. We should run from it, which once again totally went against everything that I was taught growing up as a man. I always thought that it was right to fight the things that were going on. Yeah, man, face it head on, you know, deal with it. The Bible's telling you to run away. That's what the Bible's telling you to do. Now, the reason why the Bible's telling us to do this is because the Bible understands how powerful the draw of sin is. It's strong. It is so strong. And we don't actually want to admit how strong it is. I would like to look at you guys and just be like, dude, you know what? I get lust in my heart, but you know what I say to that lust? I say no, you know. And I look it in the face, I say nay, you know, get out of here, lust, you know. And then I conquer it. What's up? I rebuke you. Yeah, the Lord rebuke you. Get out of here. Be gone. You know, and someone hits me in the head and I fall down. Yeah. But anyways, you know, that's the take it, Satan. And that's the way I'd like to believe that my fights against lust go. But, you know, it was really clear to me in my struggle with pornography how weak I really was. Because even though every day I would go home and say, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to watch it, I found myself watching it. And it was embarrassing for me to say that to anyone. Because, I mean, the obvious answer that somebody could give me is like, dude, you know, I'm struggling with viewing porn. The obvious answer someone could say to me is, well, stop. Just stop it, dude. Just don't turn it on. Just don't click it. I mean, how hard is it to not click something? Right? I'm doing it right now, you know. That's the answer that people would give you. I'm like, man, you know, what is wrong with me? Why am I so weak? I don't get it. Why am I so weak? But then I read these passages and I realized, you know what the truth is? We are all that weak. The power of sin is stronger than all of us. The pull of sin is stronger than all of us. And God is not trying to teach us how to be strong, but He's trying to teach us how to be weak and dependent on Him. See, the reason why I was trying to be strong, really, what God was revealing to me when He said, you know, you don't want to be strong, you want to be proud. What He was really revealing to me, what He was trying to show me, is I wanted to go before God and say, God, look, I conquered this demon of lust for you, you know? When Jesus would look at me and He says, no, I've conquered all sin for you. See, it's not about you and me standing up to our flesh and defeating it. It's about us relying on Christ for the victory. Right? That's what the Christian life is about. It's about being dependent on Him, which we hate. We don't like that. I don't want to be weak. I want to be strong. But Paul in 2 Corinthians 12, he says this. He was afflicted with something. He says, I prayed to God 3 times for Him to remove this from me. And Jesus responded to me and He says, my grace is sufficient for you. For in your weakness, my strength is made perfect. And Paul says, therefore, I boast in my infirmities and my weaknesses. For when I am weak, then Christ is strong. And if you don't understand the weakness and the frailty of your flesh, I got bad news for you. It's not because you're strong, it's because you're not fighting. Okay? If you're just content, just, you know, when I was an atheist, by the way, I didn't feel this fight at all. I actually didn't think I fought. You know, when I wanted to view porn, I viewed porn. When I wanted to lust after a girl, I lusted after a girl. There was no contention. There was no battle or warfare inside of me. Do you guys get that? In fact, I would talk to my friends, and they're like, you know, my atheist friends about, you know, my struggles with lust, and they'd be like, well, what struggle is that, man? Like, do you need more? Like, what are you talking about? You're battling with lust. What does that mean? You know, they didn't get it. The reason why they didn't get it is because they never fought it. You do not understand the strength of your flesh until you stand up to it and you fight it. So if you do not feel any tension inside of your heart, it's not because sin is weak in you. It's because sin is so powerful in you that you are obeying its every whim. You are going wherever it wants you to go. And you've justified yourself in your own mind thinking that there's nothing wrong with you when there really is. The more you stand up to your flesh, the more wicked you're going to understand you are. I mean, look through the Bible. When you look through the Bible, when you look at the saints of the Bible, the people who really got it right, you see an adverse thing happening, something that you wouldn't expect. It seems like the more victory that people experience in the Bible, the more wicked they see themselves, which is really weird. Go through the Psalms. If you read any of David's early Psalms, he's always like, God, vindicate me according to my righteousness. God, strike down my enemies, for they are wicked before you. God, show me how righteous I am in your path, you know, and he's saying a lot of that stuff. And you're like, yeah, you're reading it as a young man. You're like, yeah, that's awesome. But then you read the Psalms that he wrote towards the end of his life. You know what he's saying? God, my sins have gone over my head. I can't even bear them. He says, God, give me the wings of the morning that I might fly away from this place and be alone. You know, he's totally oppressed by his sin. And you're like, what happened? Did David become a worse man at the end of his life than he was at the beginning? No, he was a far better man than he was at the beginning of his life. But the closer you get to God, the more wicked that you see yourself. The best way for me to explain this to you guys is back in ancient civilization, back in ancient man, we used to believe that the sun was pretty close to us. And so the assumption was is that the closer you got to the sun, the hotter it would get, right? That just makes sense. You see the sun, it looks pretty close. I bet I could get to it. And in fact, there's that famous story, right, of the father and his son that make the wings out of feathers and wax. You guys know the story, Daedalus and his son? And they end up flying, and what does he tell his son? Don't fly what? Don't fly too close to the sun, man, you're going to die. And so Daedalus, he ends up flying a little bit too close to the sun. The wax what? Melts, and he falls into the ocean, and he dies. So the assumption of ancient man was always that the sun must be really close, and the closer you get to it, the hotter it must become, right? That made sense to us. That's right. It's a Greek mythology story. That's absolutely correct. But you know what actually happened when we started getting really close to the sun? It got colder. And we're like, that's weird. Why would it get colder the closer you got to the sun? It doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't it get hotter? And then we're like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to build rockets and we're going to make it into space. Then we got into space and you know what we realized? The sun is about 93 million miles away from the Earth. The reason why we thought it was so close is because it's so big. And as long as you got your feet firmly planted on the ground, you'll think, man, we're all pretty close to the sun. But the people who have actually made it the nearest to the sun are the ones who understand just how far away we are. The people that have walked on the surface of the moon, they're like, yeah, we're far. We're really far. You know, even to this day, you know, I'll watch comic books and stuff like that. Where, you know, I mean, watch comic book movies or read comics. And in the comic book movies, they, like, fly to the sun and it takes them, like, a second, you know. And you're like, yeah, that could happen, you know. But then you realize, if I was going at the speed of light, right, which is faster than any of us can travel, right? It's faster than anything can travel other than light. You know how long it would take me to get to the sun from here? 8 minutes. 8 minutes, that's how long it would take. Isn't that crazy? So whenever you read a comic and Superman makes it to the sun in like a second, you're like, yeah, that's crap. You know, like that can't actually happen, right? It would have taken at least 8 minutes to get there, flying at the speed of light, right? So it's so far away that we can't even fathom it. Now here's the thing in Christianity. As long as you keep your feet firmly planted on the ground, and all you do is you look around at your fellow Christians and you compare yourself to them, you're going to feel pretty good about yourself, right? Because you're going to look around and be like, well, I'm better than that dude, you know? I'm better than that girl, you know, so I'm pretty good, you know, and then you'll feel pretty good. But then the second you start looking up and you start getting close to Jesus, you know what you realize? I suck, right? I'm terrible. Isaiah, when he finally met God face to face, you know what he said? I am undone. I am a man of unclean lips from a people of unclean lips. He's like, not only do I suck, but my whole country sucks, right? That's what he said when he got to see God. See, any person who's convinced of their righteousness and convinced of their own standing before God and doesn't feel the conflict of their flesh between their spirit, it's not that they're holy, it's actually because they're so unholy that they don't even recognize the struggle. Paul is another good example. One of the first books he wrote was 1 Corinthians. And in 1 Corinthians, he says, I am the least of all the apostles. And you read that and you're like, it's pretty humble. But is it really? You know, the apostles were kind of like the greatest guys who ever lived. You know, so saying that you're like the least of the greatest guys who ever lived, that's kind of humble, but not really. You know, then you get to Ephesians and he goes a little bit further. Right? Ephesians was written a little bit later in his life. And he says, I am the least of the saints. And you're like, okay, you know, that's a little bit more, right? You know, he's saying that he's lower than all the other Christians, which is still, that's pretty humble. But then you get to 1 Timothy, which was one of the two final books that he ever wrote. And you know what he says? I am the chief among sinners. So he went from least of the apostles to lowest of the saints to worst piece of junk on the planet, right? And it's like, dude, again, is he getting worse? No, he's getting better. But the better you get, the closer you get to God, and the closer you get to God, the more you understand your sin. But at the end of that, he says this, "For this reason, God has shown grace upon me that I might be a pattern on those who might believe." So yeah, he was more aware of his wickedness, but did that bum him out? No, because the closer you get to God, the less you start looking at yourself, and the less you start becoming depressed about yourself. Because how could you be depressed when you're looking at someone as beautiful as Jesus? You start realizing that your life isn't about you. It's about Him. And Paul says, you know what? I'm the worst among sinners. But you know what? Jesus loves the worst among sinners. And He's awesome. Don't look at me. Look at Him. That was what his life became. Man, the more you fight your sin, the more you're going to realize the power of it. The more you realize the power of it, the more you're going to rely on God. And that is what God is trying to do in all of us. So do not become discouraged when you're fighting your flesh, but keep fighting. Because the more you fight it, the closer you're going to get to Him. It's not about winning. It's not about beating your flesh. It's about understanding how strong it is so that you might cry out in sincerity to God. Because even right now, as I'm telling you guys these things, there is a wicked part in you, and guess what? There's a wicked part in me that doesn't believe it. There's a little part of me, even though I'm saying this to you guys, there's a little part of me that's like, that's not true. I'm pretty good. You know, let's be real. You know, I'm definitely better than a lot of people, right? It's in me. I don't want it to be there, but it's there. No one can be told that they're a wicked sinner. They must be shown. And the way that you are shown is through trying and failing. Right? So when you're fighting your flesh, it's not about winning. Don't think that way. Don't be like, oh, I failed, I suck. Well, you do suck. But the failure, it's not like you sucked when you failed. You always sucked. The failure just reveals that you sucked, right? And now you could go to God in truth and be like, God, now I realize I suck and I need your help, right? And that's going to give you more dependence on God, and it's going to draw you closer to God. Now, the next thing I want to talk about... The cost of obedience. You'd think, right, when reading this story, Joseph, who was a spoiled, rotten brat, he gets to Egypt, he gets put into slavery, he finally does the right thing, right? He runs away from sexual temptation, which, by the way, happened every day. It's easy to resist one temptation, right? But when it happens every day, man, that wears on your soul, doesn't it? And he does. He resists it every time he runs away from her, and you're like, man, dude, I bet you anything that like someone's going to see him do this and Potiphar's going to promote him even more. You know what happens? Thrown into prison. See, a lot of us, we live in America and we get this idea inside of our heads that like, dude, if you live a good life, man, God's going to bless you. And he will, but that doesn't always mean a physical blessing. Joseph does the right thing and is thrown into prison. This is 2 Timothy 3, verse 10. But you have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, persecutions, afflictions, which happened to me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra. What persecution I endured. And out of them all, the Lord delivered me. Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Following Jesus is not the ticket to the good life. Following Jesus is oftentimes the ticket to the suffering life. Paul actually, he mentions three places where he suffered, Antioch, Iconium, and Lystra. At Lystra, you know what his suffering was? The people of the city dragged him into the center of the city and stoned him, thinking he was dead. They threw heavy rocks at his head until they believed that they had killed him. They dragged him out of the city and left him there. And God rose him from the dead. He walked back into the city and kept preaching the gospel. Now, when you listen to that, right, he's like, and God delivered me out of all of them. And we would assume, oh, that means that God protected him. Well, yeah, but it's not that God stopped the rocks from smacking him in the face, which would be what we would think God would do for him. God delivered him out of him, meaning that he escaped with his life. And Paul says, everyone who desires to live godly will suffer persecution. But you might be saying, but at the end of the story, Joseph gets lifted up, right? He becomes the governor of the entire nation. Isn't that what God means? That that, you know, you might suffer for a little bit like Job, but at the end of Job's life, God gives him double what he lost, and he gets a new family, and isn't it amazing, right? So you might suffer for a little bit, but eventually God will balance the books. Well, let's talk about another person from the Old Testament who also lived in Egypt. Let's talk about Moses. Okay, so Joseph was faithful to God, and he went from prison and slavery to king. Moses was faithful to God, and he went from king to what? Slave. Right? Same God, same country, same faithfulness, different ending. Moses went from the palace to dying alone in the wilderness on a mountain. Right? That is what happened to Moses for being faithful to God. So can God bless you physically? Yeah, he does it all the time. Many people prosper who follow the Lord. But you know what? Many people don't. And when you think too simplistically and you think, man, being faithful to God is going to give you everything that you want, then you are not being honest with the reality of the world. What about those Christians who were killed just a couple weeks ago in Egypt and bombed by a terrorist inside of their church? Are we really going to look at them and be like, well, it's because they were unfaithful? They must not have been serving God enough. No, they were serving God probably more than you and I do. And yet, that didn't lead to their prosperity. It led to their death. Okay? Walking with God doesn't always lead to physical prosperity. And that leads to my final point, my final 2 points, should I say. God's healing and deliverance and prosperity in our lives is far higher than what we want. See, we want God to just give us more stuff and give us a better life. And that's what we think is going to make us happy. But here's the thing. Here's the truth. The stuff that you have, as great as it is all going to burn. And it doesn't compare to God. And sometimes God brings us through suffering to realize just how weak and empty these things are that we're putting our faith in. Sometimes God takes these things from us so that we realize that the best joy is in Him alone. Remember what I said about Joseph? What kind of person was Joseph before he went to Egypt? Was he a good guy? No, spoiled. Spoiled, rotten brat. And he goes from a spoiled, rotten brat, some dude who is completely obsessed with himself, goes to Egypt, right? He's being screwed over in every single way. Some attractive older woman wants to have sex with him, and he says no. And you know the reason he gives for not having sex with her? He says, how can I do this evil and wickedness before God? And most people in here, we would look at that situation and be like, dude, you know what? God has abandoned me. Screw God. You know what? He hasn't looked out for me. Here's this woman. She wants to have sex with me. Who am I? Why would I say no to that? God hasn't been faithful to me ever. Man, he took away everything that was important to me. Man, I'm going to get back at that guy. I'm going to have sex with this girl, and I don't even care, right? That's what most people would have done in that situation. But Joseph, instead, he stays faithful to God. And you'd be like, why would Joseph do that? Why would Joseph possibly see God as being faithful in the most deep pit of suffering and despair he's ever experienced? And this is why. In this pit of despair, Joseph had built his life. He had built his life around his father and his family. That was his value. That was his treasure. That was his worth. That was his everything. God strips all of that away from him. And you know what? He sees finally where his true treasure is. He sees finally that God was always my treasure. God was always the person that was there for me. Who prospers him when he's at Potiphar's house? God. Who takes care of him when he's in prison? God. Every person in his life abandons him and rejects him. His brothers abandon him for dead. Potiphar, who was his new boss, who he thought, this dude's going to look out for me, he screws him over. He goes to the prison. He helps out those two guys. He's like, surely this guy's going to help me out. What does he do? Forgets about him for 2 years, right? Every person that comes into Joseph's life screws him over and abandons him. But you know, the one person who remains faithful through it all is God. It's God. God is the only person that remains faithful to Joseph. And so because of God's faithfulness to Joseph, he learns a dependency and an intimacy with God that leads him to deeper understanding and joy than he ever experienced in all the prosperity of the world. Speaking of Moses in Hebrews chapter 11, when Moses had everything, the writer of Hebrews says that as Moses was in the riches of Egypt, he says he longed for the afflictions of the Israelites that he might know God. You guys understand that? Here's a dude that was in the top. He was the Pharaoh. He was everything. Everybody loved him. Everybody adored him. He had riches and women and power and everything you could ever want. And he looked at slaves and he says, their God is so beautiful that if I had him in slavery, I would take that any day over all, everything I have in the palace. And he actually made that trade. See, God claims that he alone is beautiful and worthy and awesome and glorious. Not the things he gives us. He says that he is worthy. And the only way that you're going to discover his worthiness is through suffering, which is why sometimes he brings us through this particular types of suffering. See, we want something so small, but God wants something so great for our lives, something far greater, something eternal. This is 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. He says, therefore, in our suffering, he says, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is being destroyed every day, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Joseph counted God so faithful, so beautiful, so glorious, that everything that he was losing, he says, I count it joy for the knowledge of God. That the more I lose, the more I gain. The more I suffer, the more I'm prospering. Because I get to know God just a little bit more every day, and he counted that as his everything. That's what changed his life. That's what changed him from being a spoiled, rotten brat to one of the greatest men in history. It wasn't prosperity, it was suffering. In fact, I have a quote. I thought it was really interesting because it was by a Christian that I can't pronounce his name. It's like Alexander Stowe something or another. I can't pronounce it at all. But in his testimony, he went to prison. And I think it's really interesting because he was an atheist before he went to prison, and he became a Christian in prison. This is a guy, and he didn't go to a good prison either. This is a Russian writer who was in a forced labor camp under Joseph Stalin, right? This is Russia, man. They don't mess around when it comes to prison, right? He's in one of the worst hell holes on the planet. And this is what he writes. He says this, it was granted to me. Isn't that weird? It was a gift. It was granted to me to carry away from my prison years on my bent back, which nearly broke beneath its load, this essential experience, how a human being becomes evil and how one becomes good. In the intoxication of youthful success, I had considered myself to be infallible, and I was therefore cruel. In the surfeit of my power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, though, I was convinced that I was a good person, and I was well supplied with systematic arguments for that purpose. It was only when I lay there in a rotting prison cell that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not between states, not between classes, not between political parties, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. That is why I turn back to the years of my imprisonment and say, sometimes to the astonishment of those about me, bless you, prison. I have served enough time there. I nourish my soul there. And I say without hesitation, bless you, prison, for having been in my life. Isn't that a weird quote? Now, the reason why I like it so much is because do you see how much it reflects Joseph's experience? That before he went to prison, he was spoiled. He thought everything he did was great. But then he went to prison, and this is what this guy is saying. He's saying, before I went to prison, I thought I was the best person ever, even though I was murdering and oppressing people. Because he understood, he thought that evilness, wickedness, was determined by political parties or class. So the people he was oppressing, he was like, well, they're not in my class, so they're not actually people. And he felt really happy about that. But then he went to prison and he started hanging out with these people that he probably oppressed himself. And he started realizing, you know what, these people are actually people. And I oppressed them. And in that moment, he started to realize how wicked he was, and that understanding of wickedness drew him to the Savior Jesus Christ. And that is where he got saved. And that's why at the end of his life he says, man, I thank God for prison. a weird thing to thank God for, right? But he praised God for prison because of what it did for him. See, it wasn't about a physical blessing for this guy. It was about learning the knowledge of Jesus Christ. It was coming into contact with him. They made all of it worth it and all of it actually amazing. We do not look at the things which are seen, but we look at the things which are unseen by faith. Whatever suffering is entering into your life, whatever thing is happening inside of your life, its purpose, God's intention in it, is to bring about a deeper knowledge, understanding, and reliance upon him, which is far greater than any physical blessing that he could give you. Sometimes when we talk about suffering in the Christian church, we kind of talk about it like, you know, it's not what God wants, but it's what he allows. You know, we'll say it like that, which is true to an extent. But this is what we tend to get away from it. It's like God is up in heaven and he's like, oh crap, I didn't want that to happen. Oh man, well, I'll try to make it work, you know, and like he'll like alter his plan to try to make your suffering do something good, right? But that's not what we see in Joseph's life, is it? If Joseph would have never suffered, he would have never entered into being the governor of Egypt. He would have never saved the world, and he would have never had a relationship with God. Suffering wasn't God's plan B. God only has a plan A. Any suffering that enters into your life, as wicked and as horrible and as terrible as it is, God has a plan for it. And you're never going to understand that plan by saying to God, like, well, you know, I guess you'll make something good come out of this. No, everything that happens in your life is for a purpose and a reason. God doesn't do anything by mistake. So that means that it's happened, it's for his glory and your betterment. And we as Christians have to understand that. We spend far too much time in the church talking about how to get out of suffering, when that's not the intent of the Bible. The intent of the Bible is not to get you out of suffering, but it is to give purpose to your suffering, which is far greater a blessing. Now, the final thing I want to mention about Joseph's story is the names of his sons. He names his first son Ephraim, and the second son he names Manasseh. Ephraim means forgetting, to cause to forget. And he says when he names his son Ephraim, he says, because God has caused me to forget the pain and toil of my childhood. Now, we have to understand what Joseph means by this. It doesn't mean that Joseph got hit in the head like Jason Bourne and forgot his past, and now he doesn't remember like what happened to him. That's not what he's saying. He's saying that God has done something to him, that when he thinks about his past, he is no longer filled with anguish and suffering and regret, but he's filled with hope. Which is why the name of his second son, Manasseh, means fruitfulness. So this is what I mean. This is how God helps us to deal with trauma and sorrow and darkness that's in our past, that anguish that holds us down. Man, because I struggle with depression, I know how easy it is to be dragged down by your past and how easy it is to let those scars from your past just drag you down instead of complete you, which is what God's intent for them are. And the only way to do this is to understand the fruit that God is bringing out of it. Here's to put it another way. In Hebrews chapter 12, it talks about our growth as Christians through discipline, through God's discipline in our lives. And he says, no discipline seems good at the moment, but he says it seems painful. And he says, but to those who are trained by it, they will bear the peaceful fruit of righteousness. The word trained in the Greek is the Greek word gymnasio, from which we get our word, our gymnasium, right? Now, when you go to the gym, any of you guys who've been to the gym, it's not like you go to the gym and when you're lifting weights, like every rep you do, you feel stronger. You're like, man, I did one rep. And then the second rep, you feel stronger and you feel better. And you're like, I can feel this working. No, like when you do it, the more you do, the worse you feel. You're like, I feel like crap, you know? And if you knew nothing about the human body, you'd be like, working out as a gyp. Man, I think that these people are trying to kill me, man. Like, I feel terrible. I feel sore for days afterwards. I pay for this. This is terrible, man. Like, it'd be the worst thing ever. The only way that you could work it out is if you knew not the pain of working out, but the fruit that comes from it. You guys understand that? In fact, to people who work out often, they'll tell you, me included, there's a pleasure to working out. Now, people who don't work out often, you're like, that's crap. That's not true. There is. There's a pleasure to working out. But let me tell you something. If fruit didn't come from working out, I wouldn't work out. I'm not saying to you guys that, like, yeah, if I worked out and nothing happened and I became fat anyway, I would still work out. No, there's no way, man. Like, it's for the fruit. The pleasure in working out is through the knowledge of the fruit that is being gained. Joseph looks at his past and he sees the rottenness that happened to him. He sees it. It's not like he's blind to it all of a sudden. He sees it, but he also sees simultaneously, he sees the fruit that God is producing in his suffering. And so because of that, what he's forgotten is not the memories, he's forgotten the pain. Right? That's what happens to us as Christians. The world will tell you to suppress those memories, but if you suppress them, they don't go away. And that pain certainly doesn't go away either. The world will also tell you to talk about them. Talking about them can help, but more often than not, just brings up bad memories and it makes you feel worse. The only way to deal with these things is to forgive the memories. And the only way you could forgive them is if you start praying for the eyes of faith that you could see the fruit that God is bringing through your suffering. You'll never see the full picture in the moment. But as you grow older, you'll start seeing bits and pieces of God's glory within every piece of suffering that you go through. Right, so we pray for the eyes of faith, and that's what enables us to go through suffering. Let's pray, and then I think we've got another worship song, right? Dear God, I want to thank you for this section of Scripture, Lord, that Joseph was a man who learned this lesson. Lord, as painful as it was, he learned from the suffering that you put him through. I thank you that you teach us these things, and I thank you that you are a God who doesn't stay distant from suffering, but you're a God who suffers with us. Lord, you went to the cross for our sakes. You've experienced every pain that we have, and we thank you for that, Lord. I pray that we would learn from you. I pray that we would come to you in our time of need, and that you would teach us to see things through your eyes. Lord, help us to have faith and trust in you. And in your name, amen.